Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people who we have the privilege of talking with more regularly and with greater impact than our friend Andy McCarthy. He brings uncommon intelligence to the issues of our day, particularly that nexus between international and national security and the law. He is a former federal prosecutor who successfully took down terrorists. He has been working ever since, trying to ensure that they do not do further damage to our country, either in the violent way or the stealthy way, the subject of two of his superb books, Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad. You can find his writings at National Review Online and PJ Media, but we especially appreciate his visits with us. Andy, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Morning, Frank. How are you?
Good. I'm very pleased to catch up with you for several reasons. First, to get a, damage assessment, I guess, of the Flynn debacle. What do you make of Mike Flynn's resignation, and where do we go from here?
Well, I think, Frank, that it's one of these things where if the administration ultimately gets its people in place and implements policies that demonstrably benefit the country, this will be barely remembered. It'll be a blip on the screen at most. If, on the other hand, there's a descent into disarray, and there is some reason to be a little bit concerned about that, I think, then it's going to be remembered as a sign that there were problems. We got to remember, President Trump is 25 days in, and he's got a lot of people in his inner circle who are visionary in their own ways, whether you like their visions or not is a different story, but they've not had hands-on experience running the government and running the executive branch of the, you know, $4 trillion a year federal government is not the same thing as running even a vast, closely held, mainly family company like Mr. Trump did before he became president. So, you know, I think you're seeing some growing pains here. And personally, with respect to Flynn, I think the allegations that he may have violated the Logan Act are silly. No one's ever been prosecuted under the Logan Act, which generally prevents private citizens from trying to conduct a sort of, you know, on the fly foreign policy. But we're talking about somebody who was about to be the national security advisor. So it's only natural that he'd be having conversations with the representatives of foreign governments. Where it's a problem is if he provided misinformation to people like Vice President Pence, who then, you know, went public in reliance on it, that's a big deal. So I guess we'll find more out in the coming days.
We will know, and I think you're absolutely right to keep your eye on the ball. It really comes down to, are we going to have a consistent and strengthened team that is advancing the policies that President Trump ran on and has articulated, you know, since he came to office, specifically, Andy, with respect to defeating what he calls radical Islamic terrorism. And I wanted to turn next to the executive order. We talked about it a little bit last week. We've had yet another court ruling since we spoke, namely in Virginia, that seems to further reinforce this idea that the president is acting in an unconstitutional fashion, overreaching his authorities. I know you don't agree with that, but I wonder where you think we are in the aftermath of this ruling, and more to the point, this idea of simply rewriting the executive orders to sort of negate all of these cases.
Well, I think that's where we're headed, Frank, and there's no way to negate them, because I think there's a fundamental disagreement between the president and the courts that have weighed in thus far, at least some of them. There's a decision that goes the other way in Massachusetts, if I'm remembering right. But, you know, even understanding that there are disputes, you can certainly make it a smaller target. And I think you know, between the way the administration kind of chaotically implemented this order, law that was pretty solidly in the president's favor has been, at least in the application of it, undermined by the fact that they did some things in the rollout of this that were gratuitously damaging to what they were setting out to do, not least, you know, things like applying the order to lawful permanent residents. No one is saying that you can't have a lawful permanent resident who's a terrorist. You know, I'm sure it's happened before. I think it's even happened in one of my cases. But, you know, lawful permanent resident aliens go through a screening process that's much more thoroughgoing than anything they're going to impose, even in connection with what President Trump has called the, you know, extreme vetting, or what I prefer to call heightened vetting. So, you know, I think that was the kind of thing that was a mistake that they, what do they call it in tennis, an unforced error. And there's too many of those because, let's face it, a lot of these policies have a lot of enemies on the left, and they are going to exploit every miscue you make. And I think that's what's happened here.
Well, it's the left, and of course, it's also the Islamists amongst us, and you've done a lot of work on exposing them. I think one of the most important pieces you've written, and I say that advisedly because there are so many to choose from, was one that you placed in the National Review Online over the weekend, entitled American Security and Islamic Reform. Would you quickly describe what you're getting at there in terms of the necessity of working with Muslims who don't want to live under Sharia and don't want to impose it on the rest of us, instead of working closely with those who want both of those outcomes, as has been the case under the Bush and Obama administration?
Well, I thought I was trying to get to a question, Frank, that would kind of cut to the chase of what we're dealing with. And I think the question really is, do you think Islam needs reform? Because if you do, then I don't see that there's any sensible departure from the idea that we have to have heightened vetting. And because the question of does it need reform, assuming people answer that in the affirmative, if you answer it in the negative, that's a good thing to know because you're part of the problem, not the solution. But if you answer it in the affirmative, then the question, of course, becomes, well, what needs reforming? And what I've been arguing for a number of years is that Sharia supremacism, which is a strain of Islam, is not really religion. It's a totalitarian political ideology that has its own repressive legal code. And I think Islamic reformers, who are very courageous because they're the targets of a lot of venom and worse from the other side, but they will tell you that it is severable, that is, Sharia supremacism is severable from Islam, the spiritual creed. And nobody, you know, least of all me, is claiming that there's any problem with Muslims who are spiritually oriented, who simply follow the theological tenets of their faith. What we're trying to get at here are people who are anti-constitutional and anti-American, because their ideology is what feeds jihadism and makes it inevitable. So I think you need to ask every politician in Washington whether they think Islam needs reform or not, because if they don't, we really need to know that. And the other thing I think President Trump needs to do, if he wants to sell this idea of heightened vetting, is incorporate reform Muslims into the process, so we can make clear here that the antagonist in the equation is not Muslims. You know, to help the other side frame this as America versus Muslims is not helpful, and it's going to make this a very difficult sell policy-wise. But I think if you incorporate Muslims into the process, number one, you show that it's not Muslims who are the problem. And number two, reform Muslims are much more versed in the controversy than people like, frankly, President Trump and some of the advisors around him. They would know the right questions to ask in a sensible vetting process that would figure out you know, who are the Sharia supremacists and who are the pro-American Muslims?
Yeah, crucial issues and highly controversial, notably because the authorities of the faith, as best I can tell, think that strain, as you call it, is the true faith. But it is a way of differentiating, for sure, between Muslims who share our values and who should be welcome into this country and those who manifestly do not. And Andy, as always, we thank you for conceptualizing these very important approaches to vexing problems of our time and for sharing them with us. I hope you'll do so again soon. Come back to us very soon. Next up, Paul Sperry will join us. We'll talk a little bit more about these Sharia supremacists on Capitol Hill at Georgetown University and elsewhere right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Paul Sperry, one of the great investigative reporters and serious students of the challenge posed to us by the threat we talked about a moment ago with Andy McCarthy. He calls it Sharia supremacism. That works for me. And it's not just over there. It's here as well, as Paul Sperry has documented in, among other things, two terrific books, Infiltration and Muslim Mafia. You can also find his writings at the New York Post and also at counterjihad.com. We're very pleased to have him with us, as always. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Frank.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about here, Paul. I could usefully discuss with you, I suspect, the Flynn debacle, his meltdown, and the loss of a man who clearly was pretty calibrated on this threat from the jihadists. You've written, in fact, recently in the New York Post about some efforts that he had in mind to try to correct the propagation of this ideology in our schools. But there's a particular school that I wanted you to just mention in that connection, if you would. At my alma mater, Georgetown University, there is something called the Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. This is a prominent operation used for, I think, interfaith dialogue and subverting our faith community. But its relatively new director is a fellow by the name of Jonathan A.C. Brown, a convert to Islam. And he unburdened himself of a rather scandalous speech last week. Could you talk about what on earth we're facing here in our universities and schools and more?
Yeah, well, Georgetown has a huge endowment from the Saudis. And so this guy, this Muslim convert, Islamist, John Brown, is basically on the Saudi payroll. And he's talking about how giving speeches at IIIT and some of these other Muslim Brotherhood front groups, talking about how slavery and even rape of women is immoral because, you know, citing the tradition of Muhammad, which is just simply outrageous, but no one's calling them out on it.
Calling people out on it seems to be the bare minimum. What else could we be doing about this, Paul? And what did Mike Flynn have in mind, for example?
Well, Flynn really got it on the threat from not just Islamic terrorists, but the whole terrorist support network that's run by the Muslim Brotherhood inside America. And he wanted to go after them in much more creative and effective ways than even the Bush administration, which happened to be actually infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood, unfortunately, because they weren't aware of what was going on. But fortunately, Flynn got it. Unfortunately, Flynn is gone. And he had a great plan to actually use social media to go to the schools and have what he called information warfare against the enemy. And that is so important, to expose what they're doing behind the scenes.
Yeah. We heard from one of his subordinates, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, a friend of this program and ours, who was making a similar point at the Heritage Foundation the other day, Paul Sperry. And, you know, we're often told, the folks like thee and me who discuss these things and document them, that we're engaged in some sort of conspiracy theorizing. In, among other things, your book, Infiltration, you were able fairly clearly to demonstrate that this is a conspiracy, all right, but it's not our theory. It's the theory being operationalized by the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, it's not a theory. It's not a conspiracy theory, and it's all based on, and that's what I use in my books, is court documents. The Justice Department has, it's on record, they've, through evidentiary exhibits, shown that there is an actual Muslim Brotherhood operating, full operation inside America, operating through a number of front groups. And they have a mission to infiltrate and sabotage and destroy the American system from within. And it's using their own documents and archives and manifestos, inciting them. They've been translated from Arabic. These are secret documents that FBI agents discovered and Justice Department prosecutors have validated and confirmed and actually introduces evidence in court trials that have actually succeeded in convicting Muslim Brotherhood leaders of terrorism and material support of terrorism. So it's not a theory, it's reality. And I've also used the deeds and the other documents to show that these MOFs, a number of MOFs, these are MOFs that have graduated, a number of hardcore Al-Qaeda terrorists, are actually controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, the North American Islamic Trust, I believe, is the architect of that. Paul Sperry is talking about books, among other things, that the Center for Security Policy Press has published. And if you're interested in checking out the explanatory memorandum or a new product called Care is Hamas, please go to securefreedom.org. You can download them there for free. Also, check out Paul's terrific books, Infiltration and Muslim Mafia, among other things. Paul, let me turn to one example that's very much on our mind at the moment of infiltration. It would seem the jury is still out. The investigation is still underway, I guess, but there certainly seems to be a problem with three, by some estimates, four, at least three brothers from Pakistan who were operating IT services for, by some estimates, 30, 40, 50 House Democrats. What do we know about what's gone on here and how serious a problem it may be?
Yeah, I looked at these Muslim IT staffers, their salaries, and it's public information. Most of they were on contract. They were shared by a number of these Democrats, all Democrats, by the way, no Republican hired them. But it wasn't just 50. It was close to 100 of these Democrats, as it turned out. And they made some close to $200,000 a year, just being traded bounced among all the Democrats. And they were in the Intelligence Committee working computers, and there was breaches. And now the police of Capitol Hill have conducted an investigation and found that there was breaches of security and tied it back to them allegedly. And
even of classified networks on the Hill, Paul, I hadn't heard that before. It sounded as though they may have had the run of the unclassified communication systems of the House and certainly of these members that they were working for, including their perhaps personal and sensitive emails. But are you saying that they've actually breached security of classified networks as well?
The fact that they're working with the Intelligence Committee, they more than likely it will turn out that they had access to other systems.
Interesting. I had, again, been told that they had been working for members of the committee, but that they'd not actually been detailed to the committee or had access to theirs. Well, we'll know more about all of this shortly, but I do appreciate you calling attention to the gravity of this potentially and how it seems to fit this larger profile of these enemies within, shall we say. Paul, let me very quickly ask you about a very important piece that you wrote this week in the New York Post about President Obama's efforts to sabotage the Trump presidency.
Well, before we go there, I was just going to mention that what we're seeing in this potential infiltration by Islamists on Capitol Hill, this is something that Sue Myrick, who was on the Intelligence Committee, she warned about in 2009 with a few other Republican members of Congress, and they were chastised and just run through the ringer by the Council on American Islamic Relations, which tried to do a smear campaign on them. But this is what they were warning was very, very prescient, and this is what I talk about in Muslim Mafia, where you have a situation where CARE, we actually got a document from inside CARE's headquarters that it was a strategy document that said, look, we're going to infiltrate the Homeland Security and the Intelligence Committees on Capitol Hill, and we're going to put our people in place as staffers and interns, and they did that.
Yeah. This is a critically important piece of evidence. We need to dust that off and push it out again. Paul, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid, so we'll come back to you on the Obama takedown of the Trump presidency, but this is really important stuff. Thank you so much for the great work you do with the New York Post and counterjihad.com. Let's get back together very soon. Next up, Rick Manning joins us. We'll talk with him about the departure of Michael Flynn and what it might mean for the Trump presidency and much more after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jessica Vaughn. These days, she is the Director of Policy Studies for an organization that I consider to be simply invaluable in Washington, D.C. It's called the Center for Immigration Studies. Amazingly, Jessica has in her past service in the government of the United States as a foreign service officer, with time spent in garden spots of the universe, including Belgium and Trinidad and Tobago. She has frequently contributed to the public policy debate about immigration and related issues in all the right places and a few not so right places, to be honest. Also testifying on these matters as an expert witness on Capitol Hill and in state agencies. It's a great pleasure to have her back. Jessica, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Glad to be with you, Frank.
Well, we're in the midst of a major thrash, of course, about this executive order of the president on immigration. And you've done a study, which is very helpful and seems quite responsive to some of the criticisms that we've been hearing of it, namely that there are seven states, seven nations that we should be concerned about. That was the view, I hasten to add, of the Obama administration and the Congress. But tell us why it should be our view as well.
Well, there have been 580 terror cases prosecuted since 9/11, and 380 of the individuals convicted were foreign nationals. And in fact, 72 of these individuals originally came from the seven countries that were paused by the president's vetting order: Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, and Sudan. And these individuals entered in almost every immigration category that we have, whether it's student visas, refugees, green cards, and what have you. And a number of them were convicted in very serious terrorism crimes, like using a weapon of mass destruction, conspiracy to commit terrorism, material support, money laundering, weapons possession. Many of them were willingly providing help to groups like Hezbollah. One of them was a heroin dealer to make money for Hezbollah. So this is serious activity, and it exposes, number one, how unfortunately ignorant these Ninth Circuit judges were in concluding that there was no risk from these seven countries, but also reminds us of why this executive order was necessary, because of inadequate vetting we've done in the past that has put our country at risk. And we're lucky most of these didn't result in anything, but, you know, we can't rely on luck.
Yeah, that's right. Luck is not a strategy, that's for sure. Based on your study, Jessica, how do you respond to the point that there are perhaps problems with these seven countries, but there are problems with others as well that have been known to be wellsprings of terrorism? Should this list be considered to be a bare minimum, really, of countries from which we ought to be pausing immigration?
Definitely. But these are the seven countries that the Obama administration and Congress identified, as you mentioned, that should be subject, travelers from there should be subject to special scrutiny. I've tried to do this vetting as a consular officer, and it's not that easy. But one of the things it depends on is cooperation with the host government so that you can verify identity documents and so on. We can't do that in Syria. It's hard enough in places like Pakistan. But, of course, there are travelers from Europe as well that could be a problem. The Trump administration could not shut down travel or entries from all of those countries or suspend it. So they took a pause on the ones that seemed to pose the greatest risk and were already subject to special conditions to get a better vetting system in place. And we need to do that so that travelers from all over the world can be subject to a level of review that gives us confidence in our immigration system, not exposes us to unnecessary risk.
Yeah. Jessica Vaughn is our guest from the Center for Immigration Studies. You can find her work and that of others, that terrific organization, at cis.org. Jessica, on that point, let me just ask you, based on your experience as a consular officer, it's been said to me that this is a problem not so much of vetting, really, but of background investigations. And as you know, from having been in some countries where you have to do, you know, some careful scrutiny of people coming through, there are places, including, I think it's fair to say, in these seven countries where Americans simply could not conduct a real background investigation. Not just that they can't get information from the government that's worth a damn, but they can't actually, you know, independently verify things like where people lived or who they hung with and that sort of thing. How serious a concern should that be?
It's a very serious concern. As you point out, the government needs to be able to independently, if possible, verify claims of these individuals for their credibility. Because I know this will shock many of your listeners, but people lie. And
no.
ISIS has has promised to infiltrate our immigration system, and I'm willing to take them at their word on that. One need only look back to the case of the San Bernardino bombers, where Tashfeen Malik's visa really should – I've reviewed her visa application that was reviewed by the government, and there were a number of red flags in it that were not pursued by the officers reviewing her application. And clearly, in hindsight, you know, there were problems. Her husband's sponsorship should have been reviewed as well. So it is important that the government look at our vetting process from start to finish and come up with a better way. There are things that we know that have worked well in the past that were suspended by the Obama administration that can be reinstated, must be reinstated, if we are going to continue to have an immigration system. And again, it's not just people coming in on tourist visas or student visas like the 9/11 hijackers. I found 17 refugees in this group from the seven problem countries that were subject to the vetting order, who originally came as refugees and then were criminally involved in terrorism or support of terror. And that's a problem also because of the communities that they're living in as well, which can serve as incubators for this kind of activity.
Indeed. Well, this is a subject we were talking about a moment ago with Paul Sperry about the kind of infrastructure that's in place to do exactly that, as Donald Trump called it, radicalization in our Muslim American community. Let me turn quickly to another topic with you, Jessica Vaughn. You've also been studying this issue of deportations and arrests of felons that are now being rounded up, we're told, in some terrible, massive crackdown. Give us a sense of what's actually happening with respect to these felons that President Trump has promised to move out of the country.
Well, what happened over the weekend was a typical ICE operation where they collect a list of names of people they're looking for who are fugitives but subject to deportation. A lot of these are people who were released by sanctuary jurisdictions or because of the policies of the Obama administration that exempted so many people from deportation. So ICE officers go out and track down people who are fugitives, criminals, absconders, etc., take them into custody and put them on the path to deportation. What's different about this one is that officers were allowed to go after people that they were prevented from arresting under the Obama administration's rules. 75% of the people of the 680 that they took into custody were convicted criminals, child molesters, drug dealers, MS-13 members, attempted murder convicts. But they were also able to arrest their associates or people who maybe committed multiple low-level crimes but had been deported before. Sometimes their family members may have been taken into custody, or people who had committed crimes that were not considered serious crimes under the Obama administration, like stolen identity. So it's routine enforcement, and it's something that I think most Americans are happy to see happen again.
Yeah. I understand that the people actually conducting them, these raids, are happy to once again feel as though they're being given both the responsibility and the authority as line officers to do their jobs, a rather signal change from the time of the Obama administration, needless to say. Jessica Vaughn, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I did want to talk with you about the important study you've done at the Center for Immigration Studies on this sanctuary cities business. There's seemingly a glimmer of good news there that some of these folks are deciding they don't want to do that anymore. But we'll have you back, I hope, soon to discuss that and much, much more. Next up, we'll talk with Rick Manning of the Americans for Limited Government about what's happening as a result of the Flynn departure to the rest of the Trump administration, and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Rick Manning is the president of another terrific organization we work with closely, Americans for Limited Government. He served in the presidency of George W. Bush in the Public Affairs Office of the Department of Labor. He ran it. And he's also worked for the National Rifle Association as a state lobbyist. He is an enormously influential contributor to the public policy debate through his columns at The Hill, at Investors Business Daily, FoxNews.com, and elsewhere. And always a welcome guest here. Rick, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Not a problem, Frank.
Well, I know that you were troubled by the resignation announced last night of Michael Flynn as the president's national security advisor. Rick, give me your thoughts on what it means more generally, perhaps, for the Trump presidency and what you think might come next in terms of a national security advisor. Who should that be, and the direction that should be taken by that individual?
First of all, I think it was a real loss to the administration that Mike Flynn decided to step aside. The way Donald Trump appears to be running his administration is he has multiple points of view who argue amongst one another, and that he sifts through the information and attempts to figure out what the right answer is based on those conflicting views. Flynn was driven out by a concerted campaign begun in the Obama administration where they engaged in spying against him, and one has to presume against the president himself, throughout really a course to sabotage his capacity to lead and his credibility. And that was a project directed during the Obama administration, and one has to assume continued into the current administration, which shows that President Trump has a much bigger problem than just Mike Flynn. He has a problem of internally an active influence operation designed to determine what his foreign policy is going to be, and alternative points of view are not going to be allowed.
Rick, this is a pretty sweeping indictment. You're referring to reports, I take it, of what role the intelligence agencies played in tracking, and then what some 9 individuals did in terms of revealing some of this information about Mike Flynn?
You know, this goes back to the fake dossier that was passed around back in December in an attempt to discredit the Trump presidency before it ever came through. And it is extraordinarily disturbing that we continue to be afflicted by people who lost an election but control the apparatus, many of the people who are feeding information to the media are, in fact, not supporters of Donald Trump, and they are partisans on the other side. We're seeing that on the domestic side, and we're certainly seeing that on the foreign policy side. Even more troubling is on the inside of the national security apparatus. According to a New York Times report, they are going to basically wash out all of the people Mike Flynn brought in, they're people who changed their entire lives around in order to go into the administration, are now going to be washed out simply without much thought, it seems. Now, if it were me, the smartest move they can do is bring somebody in, the person who's above reproach, who understands what's going on, understands the conflicts in the world, is a genuine American hero, and that would be Jerry Boykin. Jerry would be an extraordinary pick, because he doesn't back down to anybody. He says what he thinks is right. And you know, Donald Trump would get an advisor who would tell him the truth. And Donald Trump could then choose between different points of view. But he would have an honest voice in that administration who basically had nothing to lose by telling the truth, isn't looking for the next job, has already served his country valiantly for years, and would be an extraordinary voice of reason who understands the conflicts our nation faces and how to deal with them.
Yeah, boy, I couldn't agree more. Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin is one of our great leaders of our military, one of the most decorated special operators, and a good friend of mine and yours, Rick, and a man that would be extraordinary in that role. I pray from your lips to God's ears, as they say. Let me ask you about two other issues that you've been following closely at Americans for Limited Government, Rick Manning, and very helpfully so, I think. I believe, in fact, a lot of your work proved influential with Donald Trump in deciding that he would oppose the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's now done that. He's essentially vitiated it. The Prime Minister of Japan was a big champion of it, so much so that he actually got his government to ratify it in the hopes that that would somehow stave off what Donald Trump is doing. How was this treated in the course of their recent bilateral meeting in Washington and then in Mar-a-Lago?
From all accounts, it looks like President Trump and Prime Minister Abe got along great in the meeting. They went out, they played golf, they developed a personal relationship, the kind of relationship that allies should have. I think that's important. The right course on trade is not a multilateral deal. It's a bilateral deal with Japan that deals with some issues that are going to be very tough issues. Japan's economy is in shambles, but we can't continue to allow Japan to manipulate their currency in order to prevent U.S. manufactured goods from entering the Japanese marketplace. That's ended up harming Japan's economy. It's harmed our economy. So we have a mutual interest in having real trade, honest trade with Japan. And, you know, Japan's a mature country now, and it's time for them to enter the world as a mature country and stand on their own 2 feet and not play the role of a third world country that needs to manipulate the currency to keep out U.S. goods. So I think we're going to have an honest relationship.
Well, that would be a big break. And if we can do that kind of honest adult trade partnership with Japan without all of the trappings of the multilateral transnational agreement that you warned of in TPP, that would be a huge stride forward, it seems to me. Hey, Rick, one other issue that you've been following and helpfully addressing for the rest of us as well is this whole issue of the internet control mechanism known as ICANN. Tell us a little bit about the latest on that and some of the opportunities that may be before the Trump administration to undo some of the damage done, perhaps, by the Obama administration in this regard.
Sure. On October 1, the Obama administration transitioned control over a certain internet functions to the vendor that was managing them, a group known as ICANN. ICANN subsequently has come under incredible pressure from China, Russia, and other countries around the world to internationalize the control of those internet functions and to allow for those countries to have a much greater say and what kind of information flows go into those countries. It's extremely dangerous in that we're seeing an internet that is going to be torn apart because of it. And it turns out, as after we finally got our FOIA request being answered by them now that there's new people in town, and it turns out they really didn't even go through basic procedures, the Obama administration. I mean, they didn't go through basic procedures to determine the right way, the dangers of turning over the internet. One example was they did not do an antitrust evaluation, even though when the internet was first being set up in the 1990s, antitrust was clearly anticipated as being a challenge because by its nature, it has to be a monopoly in terms of a lot of the functions. You can't have multiple people doing the same function. It doesn't work. So you have to have a monopoly. And that monopoly is now exists within ICANN. And it is that is incongruent with antitrust law. And the reason ICANN could have a monopoly was because they were a U.S. government contractor. Now they're not a U.S. government contractor, so they're subject to antitrust law. And they never even anticipated. They didn't have any evaluation done, which means ICANN can be blown apart by a simple antitrust lawsuit, either brought by the U.S. government or by a company, saying this is unfair competition, and ICANN, under the law, cannot survive. And that will bifurcate the internet, and it really calls for a reevaluation of whether or not ICANN should be a standalone corporation or if it should be a vendor in the United States government.
That and the efforts being made by hostile powers to take it over are two compelling reasons to undo, to the extent we can, this ill-advised action of the Obama administration. Rick Manning, thank you so much for the great work you do at Americans for Limited Government and elsewhere. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.